Go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A new week begins on the horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find the Listen Live button. You can also listen live on a wide variety of streaming platforms for your mobile, tablet, iPhone, smartphone device, Android, what have you. Place apps like TuneIn Radio and Stitcher Internet Radio. You can go to Streama.com, DAR.FM. Fairly well liked there. The podcast address is at whiterosesociety.org under the subdomain for this program. And you can also get the podcast at iTunes. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. No, really, we are beginning a brand new week of conversation radio here. It is the 13th day of May. It is 5-13-13. Wasn't that where the Munsters live? Yeah, 1313 Mockingbird Lane, wasn't it? Herman, Lily, little Paul Ryan, Spot the Dragon. Yeah. It is the beginning of a new week. And a gentle reminder that also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, you will find the PayPal button. Listener contributions are the sole means by which we manage to keep this little effort going and have done so for yea verily lo these many years. We try to raise about $150 a night, and right now we find ourselves in a hole of some, about... somewhere between $150 and $300. So raising the any given evening total is an absolute prerequisite to getting forward. We're moving up toward the middle of the month of May, and we are behind. But still, 15 at 10, 10 at 15, 2 at 75, 3 at 50, 6 at 25. Right. So being the beginning of the week, you know that we have a... What, Benny? What? Benedict in the chat room. Just one word. Ah! I can't be arg-inducing this early, yarg. But yeah, Mondays are special around. Every day is special here, but Mondays are particularly special. You know why. That's right, hurry, 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 it's Moran Monday on the horn. Morans of all stripe, all kinds, all persuasions, right-wing Morans, teabag Morans, John Birch Morans, GOP Morans, Morans of every kind and whatever. Behind this thin cybernetic veil of canvas, you will find all of those aforesaid Morans. But remember, you can't tell the Morans without a program, and this is the program that tells the Morans. You just can't tell them much. No one will be admitted after the first 5 minutes. These are shocking Morans, goofy Morans, stupid Morans, hateful Morans, hurtful Morans, mean-spirited Morans, dangerous Morans. Folks, keep your hands on your wallets and your purses and your children. The Morans can get a little grabby at times, trying to reach through the bars. Head for the hills or you'll be up to your armpits in morans. Oh, really? Holy mackerel, the morans. I mean, this is a busy, busy, busy day. Okay, we've got that cleared up, Benedict. Thank you. So we've got an entire moranescape that's now developing around the IRS kerfuffle. Curiously, the for-profit media having a difficult time reminding people that the commissioner, whom people like Marco Rubio and chinless Miss McConnell, Mitch McConnell, see how Sandra rubs off on you there, and chinless Mitch McConnell. Well, they're hollering for a resignation, and they got one. The problem is the deputy commissioner of the IRS is only the deputy commissioner of the IRS, acting as an acting commissioner of the IRS. Yeah, he's a Bush appointee. Nah, some Bush appointee would never maybe try to do something to embarrass that one in our White House. Now, would he? No, of course not. Nonetheless, yeah. And as Jim points out in an early email this evening, what about the two-year audit of the NAACP when the latter made comments against George W.'s wars? Yeah, there's that too. Oh, but this has all the earmarks of full-on kerfuffle, doesn't it? I got a feeling it's going to be busy. They're hateful. Tosh noting earlier by email some of what I just mentioned. He was a holdover from 2008 when this happened in 2011. And there's one other thing to point out here. We don't have a real IRS commissioner. Haven't had one. You want to know why things like this happen? They happen because, well, there's nobody real, there's no real captain at the helm of the ship. Next question. Why don't we have a real IRS commissioner? Guesses? Romper room? I see you. Yeah. Hands. Because we can't get one through the Senate. Why can't we get through one through the Senate? Because Harry Reid lets the Republican majority shove him around like a 90-pound weakling on Muscle Beach. Could be part of it. Maybe, just maybe. So, in a nutshell, boom, your IRS scandal, now it's over, and we can move on to the other morans. Because, good God Almighty, we got us some. This could be a 12-hour show, the morans we've got this evening. You know how for the last week or so we've been talking about the ironically named Jason Richwine, who, from the tawdriness of his attempted intellectualism, should probably be named Jason Wild Irish Rose, or Jason Thunderbird, or Jason Boone's Farm, or my personal favorite, Jason Mad Dog 2020. Jason Richwine. The guy who argued that brown-skinned folks always have been and always will be not as smart as God's white people. Even the Heritage Foundation, for whom he was working, you'll recall, last week, decided to part company with Jason Mad Dog 2020. And that's saying something. Bill Keller over at the New York Times Post wrote a bit about this whole thing over the weekend. And of course, in an attempt to keep the right-wing attack dogs, the rabid, salivating, slobbering cujos of the right from liberal media, goddamn liberal New York Times, and Coulter was right. The only shame is that they didn't fly the buildings into the New York Times. That's what she said, and she's right. In an attempt to forestall any of that idiocy, Keller wrote a little bit about the nature of think tanks. And along the way, in noting the egregious lunacy of the Heritage Foundation, for which there is evidence, which I will get to, and the Cato Institute, named after that guy who tried to foment treason and civil war in the ancient Roman Republic as a means of stopping Julius Caesar from enacting reforms that would benefit the common citizenry as opposed to merely the knights and senate and wealthy classes. Yeah, some hero, right? Yeah, he was a real Cato. Piss on Cato. But cited those two organizations, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, as being examples of, you know, right-wing lunacy, weaponized thought as a means of advancing a political agenda, yada, yada, yada. But then at the end said, essentially, yeah, but both sides do it. And now, I mean, there are all kinds of think tanks all over the world, and he cited a study or a listing of think tanks and, well, whatever. But I was thinking more in terms of purely political think tanks. And I got to thinking, it's another one of those cases where we are so outnumbered as to make Little Bighorn look like a fair fight. So you got the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, you've got the American Enterprise Institute, you've got the Center for Psychosexual Ayn Rand Studies, whatever. You've got, I mean, following in the wake of the Powell Memo in 1972, American industry and corporations began funding these think tanks such that they sprang up like mushrooms, toadstools, poisonous toadstools, after a spring rain. While our side sat back and, kumbaya, my lord, kumbaya. Until finally, sometime in the late 90s, early aughts, we finally began to get a few little outlets here and there. Media Matters was founded by a former right-wing hitman in order to push back against this idea that there's some sort of liberal media bias in this country. The Center for American Progress was founded. Our Future group was there. Or was founded. Our friends at Families USA, which is healthcare oriented and almost exclusively so. And like I said, the numbers don't add up to a fair fight. Our side worries about the fiscal year's paperclip budget and whether or not they can afford to subsidize the intern's living wage. Answer, no. And the other side eats lobster dipped in, not butter, but, oh, I don't know, the rendered fat of poor people. So, and wasn't impressed. Saying both sides do it is like saying what? Both sides get ice. I think I recall this from one of the Cossacks emails where he had a quote from Bat Masterson. Everybody gets everything in about the same quantity. Take, for instance, ice. I know that the rich get theirs in summer and the poor get theirs in winter. Yeah, both sides don't do it. Not when do it means one side is able to scream from the rooftops and manipulate media all across the landscape while the other side is down in the bottom of a 90-foot hole hollering, "Hello? Anybody there? Excuse me? It's rather dark down here." Yeah. But you just knew this was going to happen. Jason Mad Dog 2020 found a defender. I told you he'd land on his feet. And lo and behold, it was the National Review, who have now declared that Jason Mad Dog 2020's doctoral dissertation was a legitimate work that was, quote, most certainly competently executed. The author of this specious swill is and apparently, I don't know, I guess maybe his mother loves him, if she's still around, Mother's Day having just passed, Robert Verbruggen. Verbruggen. Oh dear, now I have to go and change my shorts. Verbruggen says, "The left's labeling of Ridgewine's argument as racist is especially dangerous. In modern America, it is axiomatic that racism, whatever it is wrong, and that it's a good thing. It therefore is a mistake to define racism to include falsifiable hypotheses in addition to racial hatred. If Ridgewine's view is racist, what are we to do if it turns out to be correct?" Herr Verbruggen. Oh, it hurts when I say that. Somewhere between hurts and tickles. Herr Verbruggen apparently doesn't understand the difference between real science and pseudoscience. Dr. Mad Dog 2020 is a purveyor of the latter and not the former. He could just as easily have argued that feeling around on the scalps of Hispanics and black folks for the number of bumpy places on their heads is an indicator of how intelligent they are. You know, there has been a science, it was billed as a science of that, and what was that, phrenology? But calling it a science doesn't make it one. And saying, "Boy, those brown people sure are dumb, and they're never going to be as smart as us white ones." I'm guessing Dr. Mad Dog 2020 has never watched an episode of Here Comes Honey Boo Boo Child. No? Probably oughta. But making it, oh, God. Of course, it's, yeah, the National Review gets a Moran Monday nomination. Well, naturally, everybody says in America that racism is a bad thing, and that's a good thing. It therefore is a mistake to define racism to include falsifiable hypotheses in addition to racial hatred. Is he saying that Dr. Mad Dog 2020's dissertation was a falsifiable hypothesis? Isn't that the nature of the intellectual inquiry that goes into something like a dissertation? If you've got a hypothesis and it can be falsified, it's not valid. Don't hypotheses have to be provably true? And along the way here, Mr. Verbruggen, I think you can get a shot for that, compares this idiotic 200-year-old race theory of Dr. Mad Dog 2020's with genome research. Indeed, today, he says, genome research is progressing at a rapid clip, with scientists worldwide making fascinating discoveries almost constantly. Soon, I hope this work will render the research rich wine sites, much of which is decades old, obsolete. So he's going to defend him, but he's going to... What he's saying there is that he hopes they will find the white superiority gene. This guy is actually worse than Dr. Mad Dog 2020, Dr. Thunderbird. The left would like to cut this process off, expelling from polite society, with the help of conservative think tanks in this case, any researcher who dares to defend the hereditarian view. Really? This is the hereditarian view? Because it sounds to me a little bit like the eugenicist view. But maybe hereditarian is the term that they use over at the National Review while they're flounging about with the soft-boiled egg spoon and the shrimp fork. Jesus. But it being Moran Monday and all, let's not for a minute think that the Heritage Foundation, for having absented Dr. Thunderbird from Dr. Ripple from its august presence, is somehow now sane because they're not. The other guy who was the study of the "Oh my God, brown people are going to take all our welfares" study that was so roundly dismissed, even in right-wing circles, is a creep by the name of Robert Rector. And this guy wields considerable sway in Washington, D.C. While you may, I don't know, the really, really inside baseball members of the Horn family / commune may have heard this guy's name before, Robert Rector. If you've ever looked askance at the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act and wondered about some of its more corporatist aims and goals, you might be interested to recall that what became, as it's referred to, Obamacare, once upon a time, was the Heritage Foundation's ginned-up response to what was then called Hillary Care. Guess who did that? Guess who was behind it? Right, yeah, Robert Rector. Wrecked him. Damn near killed him. Thank you, Michael. There is never a bad time for that punchline. Rector damn near killed her. Oh, thank you, Michael. Oh, that's just good. Rector damn near killed her. But also, if you've ever sat around, and some of us do this kind of thing, if you've ever sat around and thought, that welfare reform from the Clinton administration, that sure does suck ass. Because it does. Guess who? Wrecked her. Damn near killed her. You've changed the whole tenor of this discussion, Michael. Thank you. Yeah. Among other things, Herr Rector, that's just, no. In 2012, wanted to stop undocumented immigrant families from receiving food stamps. Isn't it just charming? Heritage, the Heritage Foundation. That's our heritage, starving poor people. And you know what? To a certain extent, it's true. We do have a heritage of starving poor people. I mean, nobody's going to get fat on $3.12 a day. I mean, that won't even buy you one Subway sandwich. That'll get you three cheeseburgers at McDonald's if they allow you to use your SNAP card at the Mickey D's. But you'd kind of have to spend it all at one time by a bag of potatoes, a pound of bacon, whatever, and hope for the best at day eight if you spent a week's worth of food stamps like that. But no, this jackass, this moron, who is well thought of inside what Jim calls the Forbidden City, was part and parcel of the welfare reform, the response to Hillary Care, and now is arguing, that those people are going to just break us. And as Bill Keller notes in his editorial, does so with not the most tremendous amount of academic rigor. What's interesting, however, is that, moving on to our next moron, jug ears and all, our next moron is, of course, Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III of Alabama stand. And as is necessary every time we mention the name of Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, we have to remember that he was a failed federal court nominee whose nomination under Ronald Reagan for the federal court was turned down by the Senate after it came out that he used to say things like, "Well, I used to think the Klan was kind of cool till I found out they smoked the marijuana." Or the time that he advised a black colleague of his in the U.S. Attorney's Office, "You gotta watch what you say around our women folk, boy." Right. Well, apparently, Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III gets his morning memo from Robert Rector, damn near killed her, of the Heritage Foundation. You know, of course, that some sort of immigration so-called reform is being pondered by that august body, the Senate of the United States. Well, Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III. Oh, really, if you're new to the program, that's not me just, horsing around. That's really his name. There are, in the last couple of generations, still people who were naming their children Jefferson Beauregard Sessions. Which leads one to wonder, Jesus Christ, is there a Jefferson Beauregard Sessions IV? Jefferson Davis and P.G.T. Beauregard. And some set of parents has thought that was a good idea three times. Maybe four. Don't know. But Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions the Hood is all worried about the poor immigrants. In an attempt to make a complete disaster of any immigration reform arising out of the Senate, he's offered a bunch of amendments to the bill as it exists. One of which, it's coming from Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions the Tud, so it's not astonishing, but otherwise it kind of could be. He wants to set a standard for people seeking citizenship who have been here otherwise undocumented. They must show 10 years of consistent employment during the time that they have had provisional status before they can apply for anything of a more permanent nature, like, you know, a green card. But it's not just consistent employment. It's got to be real good employment. It's got to be employment that is better than the employment earnings of 70% of the citizens of Alabamistan. That's more than 3.3 million human beings. Because what Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions the Third wants to do is say that any potential immigrant citizens would have to, for 10 years, keep and have an average income of more than 400% of the poverty line. A family of four would therefore have to be earning $94,000 a year for 10 years. They would have to earn almost $1 million in 10 years to qualify for permanent legal status. What does that mean? Well, in Alabama, it means that 3.3 million Alabamistanians couldn't qualify if they had to, if they weren't born citizens. 70% of the citizenry of Alabama does not earn $96,000 a year. Hell, I'm surprised it's not 90%. The economy in Alabamistan is damn near feudal. What does that mean nationally? Well, in the United States, 206 million of us don't make $96,000 a year or $94,000 a year for a family of four. But isn't that the same thing that Robert Rector over at the Heritage Foundation thinks? Yeah. Doesn't want them getting none of the food stamps. Don't want them getting to be no citizens. This is shameful. This is shameful. Especially when you consider that a lot of those people that, according to Rector, should be denied food stamps, they have children who are American citizens. So, the Heritage Foundation has endorsed and published a plan to impose starvation upon American citizens. And not just any American citizens, little baby American citizens. By God, that's some compassionate conservatism, isn't it? That's about, if there was any humor involved with it, it would be up there with Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal. But this isn't modest, and it ain't funny. Other things the Heritage Foundation stands for? Oh, let's see. No lawyers for people accused of terrorism. And if they do have a lawyer, the lawyer should be punished. Really. Then there's... Well, yeah, you remember the Voting Rights Act argument in front of the Supreme Court where Fat Tony Scalia described the Voting Rights Act as a racial entitlement? He didn't come up with that on his own. See, these, as crazy it is as it is, and, you know, on any given day when I'm in Washington, D.C., and I'm heading there tomorrow, program note, I walk past that place. And sometimes I just stand there and look at it. I don't know. It's like looking at the building from Ghostbusters after it's been encased in slime. I guess it comes from being sort of trained many years and years and years ago as a poet to try... Because my professor said, you know, try to see things differently. Don't just see what everybody else is seeing. And so when I stand there and I look at the Heritage Foundation, and it's a big-ass building, it's got to be worth a fortune. It sits next to a Subway and a really, really awful pizza place. Oh, God, it's bad pizza. Bad pizza, bad policy, they're neighbors, it makes sense. And I try to imagine... Not the exalted mucky mucks, you know, the Dr. Thunderbirds, the Dr. Ripples, and Rector damn near Kilders in there, and the Jim Demented's. No. I imagine the desperation of someone who has to work there for a living. A secretary, a paralegal. Who knows better than to fall for all of that horseshit? But because the mortgage has to be paid, because the car loan has to be paid, because baby's braces, orthodontics bill has to be paid, because eating food is a good thing, and one does not wish to be hated as much as anybody on food stamps is by all the predatory pricks inside that building. You sit there and you type away at all this hate. And it's everything you can do not to just scream, enough, and get up and walk out of the building and say, I'll dig ditches, I'll do anything. But I won't do this. Yes, Ron, that might be Oberfuhrer for Bruggen. Actually, it sounds kind of Dutch to me. But Ron and Raleigh with a query says, Bob, if Mr. Rich Swine posits, oh, that's a good one too. If, as Mr. Rich Swine posits, we folks of color are collectively dumber than a sack of hammers, wouldn't that mean all the bad shit that happens is the fault of white folks? Just ask. Now, see, that's that attempting to think thing, and Mr. Dr. Rich Swine does not appreciate it. But yes, it does. Or I don't know. Maybe it's all the maybe there's so many dumb brown people out there that it's all that these, you know, because there's fewer and fewer smart white people, and it's everything we can do just to sort of keep it. No, I think your theory is the correct one, Ron. And speaking of white folks screwing stuff up. I go back to a note that Ron sent in shortly before showtime under the subject line, Dispatches from Hell, and by hell, Ron means North Carolina. Today's dispatch from hell is as follows. Republican lawmakers want to remove control of water from local utilities boards to a state-appointed water resources board. Who controls the legislature that would appoint this board? The Republican governor, of course. The real purpose is to privatize water, driving the cost of water to astronomical heights. Republican lawmakers want to roll back a law making it illegal to receive gifts from lobbyists and others. The legislator that proposed the rollback said all he saw around him was honest men, so he saw no need for the new law, or for the law. The legislature has passed a law in the House to not allow Tesla Motors to use their direct sales model in the state. The new law will require a dealership network. The bill is heavily backed by the North Carolina Auto Dealers Association. You know, in previous years, they were known as the North Carolina Buggy Whip Association, the North Carolina Bustle Association. You get the idea. On the national front, Ron says that Republicans want President Obama to apologize for the investigation by the IRS of 501c3 organizations, actually C4s. In the last 2 years, there's been a flood of applications for this tax-exempt status. The cutbacks to the IRS investigative arm has allowed a large number of organizations affiliated with teabagger political action groups to work tax-free. Now, because of this action, no real investigation of these political groups will be undertaken. We will be paying for these teabagging swine to undermine the government. Yeah, it's called welfare. I wonder how the teabaggers feel about that. They're on welfare now. They've got themselves some tax-exempt. Jim noting, calling SS Dr. Mengele, you're needed after all. Yeah, Dr. Rich Swine would like to have a consultation. Dr. John noting, genome research has already proved Rich Wine's thesis obsolete, just not the way this guy means. You see what I mean when I said we've got a very, very, very busy Moran Monday ahead of us? Because, to be truthful, we have not even scratched the surface. Not even. Now, we could be busy for quite some time. Well, I'll be darned. Thought I had myself a bumper all set up and ready to go, but if all I ain't got it. Son of a gun. Oh, well, we'll find something. Good little group gathering in the chat room. If you've never been there, it'd be a wonderful time to pop in. Head on radionetwork.com/chatroom. It's free. It's easy. The disaffection with Tom Hartman continues. Benedict said, God, did anyone catch him today? I had to turn the thing off. It was so pathetic. Swanning around with right-wingers again, is he? Oh, well. You'll have that. Oh, and by the way, just because it is Moran Monday, and like I said, plenty busy, I mentioned the National Review a little bit ago, and Dr. Verbruggen, go and get that taken care of. Over at the National Review online, every now and then they let this creepy old freak named Dennis Prager fling poo at a typewriter keyboard, and what comes out they print. And again, this is not the beautiful mind section of the program. I'm not stringing this stuff together arbitrarily. There are segments inside right-wingistan. There are things that drive them crazy. Oddly enough, one of the things that drives them crazy is little people, little poor people eating food. I mean, you would think out of this that, oh, Robert Rector and Dennis Prager and you'd think that they were somehow working out some sort of revenge for being rejected in auditions for the Road Company of Oliver. More, please. Dennis Prager crowing over the cancellation, the discontinuation of a program in the Los Angeles Unified School District that provided a free school breakfast plan. The name of the program was Food for Thought, and it provided free breakfast to about 200,000 students. They had the lofty goal, the LAUSD and the Los Angeles Fund for Public Education, of feeding breakfast to 450,000 students eventually. Dennis Prager says that the breakfast program is, and this is his word, not mine, destructive. Destructive. He writes, the reasons for the announced cancellation were that the program had drawn rodents and insects into classrooms and that classroom learning time was being wasted by students who were eating for long periods in class. Okay. Seems to me that says something about a problem with rodent control. We are, after all, talking about rats. Thank you, Sal, for the first contribution of the evening. That is greatly appreciated. Remember, we're trying to raise at least $150 every evening. Likely no show tomorrow night, so that's going to put us in a deeper hole because I'm going to be on the road all day tomorrow. Dennis Prager writes, however, but the rodents, insects, and disruption of class learning time are nothing compared with the... Wait a minute. destructiveness of the free breakfast itself. I understand Texas Betsy's not feeling so well this afternoon, so it's probably just as well that she's not listening, because this would make her scream. Now, I want you to hear, as read by yours truly, though not endorsed by yours truly, I want you to hear the voice of white privilege, because that's what this is. Dennis Prager, who has probably never missed a meal, Dennis Prager, who eats whatever he wants, when he wants, who has never made a choice between food and medicine, or between food for his children and food for himself, who has never sweated the phone bill, the power bill, the car payment, all at the same time. Dennis Prager, who knows nothing of actual want, writes the following. It is inconceivable that there are 5, let alone 200,000 or the projected 450,000, homes in Los Angeles that cannot afford breakfast for their child. A nutritious breakfast can be had for less than a dollar. For examples, go to the website WebMD, which lists 5 breakfast ideas for a buck. If, however, you are poor and do not have winter internet access, tough shit. Right? WebMD. Saw a story out of Texas over the weekend or late last week of the woman who has since been charged, but who attempted to treat her teenaged son's bullet wound in his leg by going to WebMD instead of taking him to a hospital. Of course, those are the kinds of decisions that get made in a country that has worse health care outcomes than, say, Cuba. Yeah, that's another story that's been laying here for a few days that I was waiting to see if I had the stomach to get after. A new report came out last week from Save the Children. It documents quite clearly the fact that the United States has the highest first-day infant death rate in the so-called industrialized world. More babies die in their first day of life in the United States than in any other so-called industrialized nation. More than Canada, more than Japan, more than Australia, more than Great Britain, more than Sweden, more than France, more than Germany, more than Italy, more than Greece. More than South Africa. And yes, more than Cuba. About 11,300 babies born in the United States die on their first day. Uh, Save the Children says they don't know exactly why it is that our rate is so high. But they think teen births, teen pregnancies, might be partly to blame. Drawing the correlation from the fact that the United States has the highest teen birth rate, again, of any so-called industrialized country. Now, when you compare something like this to a Robert Rector, to a Dennis Prager, who finds sickening the idea of having poor children eat food. That whole idea that Save the Children doesn't know why this is happening here it doesn't hold water. We know why. We just don't have the courage to say it. The Heritage Foundation is why. All these screaming pro-life GOP types in Congress who don't give a good old-fashioned tinker's damn about a child in actuality, let alone in America, are why. Save the Children's report says teenage mothers in the U.S. tend to be poorer, less educated, and receive less prenatal care than older mothers. Because of these challenges, babies born to teen mothers are more likely to be low birth weight and be born prematurely and to die in their first month. Poverty, racism, and stress are likely to be important contributing factors to first-day deaths in the United States and other industrialized countries. Half of all U.S. pregnancies are unplanned. Women whose pregnancies are accidental are much less likely to take good care of themselves and to get thorough prenatal care, from vaccines to vitamins that can protect the baby and the mother. Now, square that up alongside the GOP's dedication to abstinence-only education. Square that up against another story out of course Texas, the teabaggers in Texas are trying to force a special session of the Texas legislature . They want the special session in order to prevent government health care, Medicaid. Even though Rick Perry has, you know, told the poor of Texas to go and die, that he won't expand Medicaid, they want to make sure, dead sure, that Medicaid doesn't get expanded. A teabagger named Representative Van Taylor from Plano, Texas, says that right-wingers of members of the Texas House are, quote, absolutely prepared to go to the mat and return for multiple special sessions to prevent any semblance of Medicaid expansion. Because we love the right to life, but we don't give much about the living. Because there is a sizable voice crying out in Texas that wants access. To the expansion of Medicaid. But no. Let's see. Breakfast ideas for a buck. there ain't no $1 breakfast out there that is much of a breakfast. But that's not all. Dennis Prager, Moran, says that a free breakfast program in the schools, quote, both enables and encourages irresponsible, uninterested, and incompetent parenting. Given how inexpensive breakfast can be, not to mention the myriad public and private programs that provide food for poor households, myriad. That $3 a day comes from myriad. Any home, you got this? Pay attention. Any home that cannot provide its child with breakfast demands a visit from Child Protective Services. Who's running Child Protective Services these days? I thought so. The government. And the process by which we remove a child from a home and place it into the custody of the state, that costs what? Oh, money. Yeah. Any parent who cannot give a child breakfast is not too poor. He or she is too incapable of being or too irresponsible to be a competent parent. What if you have to be at work in the capitalist miracle before school time? Is Dennis Prager going to give you, some magic beans that'll thereby allow you to keep your job because you can't get on the job? As early as the boss man would like, so you can stay home and fix a big steaming breakfast for your youngins? Bacon, eggs, toast, juice, cereal? Yeah, I don't think so. Because that's capitalism, baby. And capitalism ain't got time for you to fix your kid no damn breakfast. And third, because Mr. Prager's on a roll and he's a moron, even where decent parents are involved, even decent, free breakfasts at school weaken the parent-child bond. Anybody want to chime in on that one? That parent-child bond weakening? You know what weakens a parent-child bond? Working two or three minimum wage jobs so that by the time your child is 18 or 19 years old, you look around and you go, I missed it all. I missed it all. And you spend a lifetime looking back and wondering if you could have done better. And knowing you could have, if only you hadn't been working two or three jobs. You know, remember George W. Bush said that was uniquely American. Working three minimum wage jobs. The parent-child bond is weakened by a child having a little bite of eat before school. Give me eat. Hundreds of thousands of parents who are able and happy to provide their child with breakfast have accepted the offer because anything free is too enticing for an increasing number of Americans. Or maybe anything free frees up a few more dollars for the power bill, for the water bill, for the mortgage payment, for the rent, for the insurance, for the car payment, for new tires, for, I don't know, more milk when the kid gets home. But then again, going back to the Heritage Foundation, those dumb bastards have actually argued with a straight face that if you own a refrigerator, you're not poor in America. Really? Anything free is too enticing for an increasing number of Americans. But what they have done, they being the parents, is to make, what they have done is made the proverbial deal with the devil. Okay, we're finally clear here. The public schools are the devil. They are not a gem of accomplishment that is the outgrowth of an enlightened viewpoint about the difference between citizens and subjects. No, they're a deal with the devil, because they are the devil. Little Johnny,
come here. Yes, it's breakfast time, little Johnny. Come here. Let me get my tattoo gun out. It just stand still. There you go, little Johnny. You've got your 666 on your forehead. Now you can have your pancake wrap.
Deal with the devil. In allowing a child to have breakfast at school, Prager says that parents have traded in one of the most fundamental definitions of parenthood, providing one's children with food for a dollar and for a little less work as a parent. Or maybe for not losing one's job. You know, these are the decisions that are made in this country. Not, I think I'm going to lay up in bed and let the kid go hungry, or, go to school, kid, they'll feed you there. That's the America that the right wing and the privileged class imagines we are. We'd all just lay up in bed watching I Love Lucy reruns, and the children would starve, pretty soon be out eating wild onions in the yard for just a little sustenance. And ultimately, if the parent accepts the free breakfast, the parent becomes, quote, less of a parent to their child. If it were not for the fact that there is an outright ban on right-wingers on this program, I'd love to hear from some right-winger and have them explain to me how having your child able to eat is demeaning. But there is a ban, so we won't. Then finally, mercifully, comes the ultimate argument against little children eating breakfast at school. Again, a quote. The free breakfast profoundly doesn't just... No, gotta have that adverb there. The free breakfast profoundly weakens young people's character. I mean, there are things that just weaken a young person's character, but eating that free food profoundly weakens a young person's character. When you grow up learning to depend on the state, and this is, you know, and that's the thing. This is an assertion. There's nothing in here. There's nothing at the bottom that says Dennis Prager grew up eating government food and only became free when he realized that capitalism and the free market were his salvation, and he pulled himself up by his own bootstraps with a boat that he built by hand that was lifted by a rising tide like all the other boats among him. He sailed to shore, stepped on the sand, and strode boldly forward into an American economic miracle. There's none of that bullshit at the bottom. Sorry. Free breakfast profoundly weakens young people's character. When you grow up learning to depend on the state, you will almost inevitably, even understandably, because you see Dennis Prager's got him some of that empathy that's been going around, understandably assume that the state will take care of you. By God, if you assume that the state will take care of you in this country, you are passing a death sentence upon yourself. The state ain't gonna take care of squat. Here's $3 a day for food. Don't eat it all in one place. And you will grow up also assuming, as do Europeans, who give far less charity than Americans for this very reason, that the state will take care of your fellow citizens, including your own children. Do you see? Is it obvious the disconnect that exists between this pathetic, fecal excuse for a human being and any concept of commonality or common good, of community? Because it's not the government taking care of someone. That's the meme that they advance. The idea is that of a common weal. That we all contribute to community. That we all make our communities better places. That we all find it in all of our best interests not to have people dying from starvation and piling up like cordwood in between the houses as if it was some sort of revisitation of the 14th century's plague. The state isn't taking care of our fellow citizens. We are. We, because we, the people, form this less than perfect union, which we attempt to make more perfect. That at least is how it's supposed to work within the vision of the people who set this whole thing up. He closes it all by saying, these are the ways in which the left has damaged children and families through free school breakfasts. Damaged. Now, we've got God knows how many studies showing that people, and especially children, do better in the beginning of the day with a full belly. That hunger contributes to an inability to learn, not an enhancement for... No! See, Prager's really pissed off because what it turns out is that the plan itself was not completely ended. The little children are going to continue to eat lunch or breakfast. They're just not going to do it in the classroom because that was drawing rodents and insects. Instead, they're going to sit down like little human beings and eat breakfast in the cafeteria. Which, of course, according to this sickening freak, is all because of the overarching power of public employee unions. Union thugs out there feeding children. This guy purports to be the founder of something that he calls Prager University. Woohoo! Can't you just imagine the curriculum there? Is your belly rumbling yet?
Yes.
Ah, you're ready to learn. More hands. Told you. Busy night. Most busy. So I suppose we will take a break. Hour and 15 minutes is long enough of a filibobster, even though there's enough material for another hour and 45 of it, if not 6 hours and 45. Jesus, the freaks pile up over the weekend. But this is a much more engaging and enjoyable time. When you participate in the conversation, we call what we do here Conversation Radio, and you are more than welcome to jump in. If you want to jump in on the Skype line, it's wide open. Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn, is the contact. And the regular phone line is, of course, 304-658-3333. Either way is fine by me. We'll take a little break. I remind you, we're trying to raise the funding to keep this thing going on a daily basis. We have $140 to go this evening just to sort of stay in the relatively shallower hole than it will be if we don't raise the funding. 14 at 10, 7 at 20. You know the drill. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com. Also, under the Contribute tab is the address for the traditional carbon-intensive mail delivery method. Your choice. But it is badly needed and absolutely necessary to continuing to do this little thing that we do. I'm Bob Kincaid.
You're gonna die.
was back in the days. What were they called? The New Romantics, Adam and the Ants, Dog Eat Dog. I love the drums in that and the reverb on the sounds like a single coil pickup guitar. Let's see. Ron and Raleigh writing, Bob, Bob, Bob. I always worry about emails that start like that. That's a spam. You can't let those poor folks think that the government will do a goddamn for them. Rick Santorum said he didn't want any of his tax dollars going to enrich the blah people. Blah. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. How's it going?
It's going. What's up?
This is Dave from Portland, Oregon again.
Hey, cool. Glad you called back.
Yeah. I was listening intently to your filibuster, and I enjoyed it very much.
Good word, isn't it? I was proud of that one.
Definitely. It had special meaning for me, too, because I had the weirdest week, man. I got to tell you, first off, you are absolutely right about the Oregon State Capitol. You can walk in that building. They don't have any security there. I mean, it's like the old days or something, you know? I went down to the Oregon State Capitol, actually, on Wednesday. It was the strangest thing. You know, remember we had the gun conversation and you made a comment? We were talking about the gun laws and you made that comment about how, I know you can walk right into the Oregon State Capitol with a pistol on your hip.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I had the weirdest week. I'll tell you what. On Tuesday, a friend of mine called me, and who's an activist friend of mine, and we're in this group for housing justice here in Portland. I'm an activist with this group.
Awesome.
And we're it's really cool. We're in this group called We Are Oregon, and we're actually what's called a foreclosure group within that. We work we're financed by the SEIU, and it's a cool thing. I've been involved with it for about a year, but we're doing other solidarity actions with other groups, and what you were talking about today, I feel really passionate about this subject of, like, you know, attacks on the poor in any way, shape, or form. But we got the same thing going on all over the country, and what's going on over here is we've got another group called Right to Dream, and these folks are homeless people, and they've taken up a small block, like in the center of the city, on 5th and Burnside, which is, Burnside is like the east-west dividing line of the city,
okay,
Portland. So it's like, you know, on the north side of that dividing line, you have Old Town, which is used to be Skid Row area, but it's now turning into, it's going upscale because
it's been gentrified.
Yeah, it's getting gentrified, totally. Yeah, but you know, you go a little bit west of there, and it's totally, they leveled like probably about 20% of the city and just totally rebuilt it, and it's like Manhattan over there. It's called the Pearl District, which used to be the warehouse district. Anyway, back to the Right to Dream. They've taken up this little tiny little block, this little lot on the corner of 5th and Burnside in Portland, and they built a little encampment there. And the Portland Business Alliance is lobbying the legislature, the Oregon State Legislature and Senate, to pass this bill to make it a crime to sit on the sidewalk, to make it a crime to stand on the sidewalk in one place, because these folks, they have a publication they do called the Street Roots, which is a lot of stories and news for the people that are down and out, and all kinds of interesting stuff, actually. But they'll sell this publication on the streets to try to, you know, earn a buck. But their Loan Business Alliance doesn't like that, and their group, like, they're mostly the banks and big businesses, Macy's and whatnot. But they've got this ordinance they want to pass that was going to criminalize this, so cops could roust you, and it's a slap at the First Amendment all the way. And my friend, who's in We Are Oregon with me, asked me if I would testify in front of the Oregon State Senate Judiciary Committee. And I said, hell yeah. And she said, okay, well, I'll pick you up tomorrow morning at 6:30 a.m. So we got off to Salem, got down there at about 9, and we sat through the hearings, and I testified, and I was really passionate about it. But I think I hit a real home run with these guys too.
Beautiful.
It was awesome. It was really, really cool. And I was, you know, guys like you, yeah, you're inspirational. I mean, you're always up there in D.C. Trying to talk to these people. And, it was weird. It was like they had this semicircular table where all the senators were sitting. And, you'd go up to the table. But I was really actually... they gave me a set of talking points, which I thought were not as hard-hitting as I wanted to be. And I got down on it, and I really just I said, this is, how do you know if somebody is homeless or not, even on the streets? I mean, I know homeless people who dress very well, and people who have a lot of money who don't dress that well. This just gives them the right to roust anybody. This is nuts. It's completely, and people have a right to be on the sidewalk. The sidewalks don't belong to the businesses. I mean, it's like, they're just trying to run the show everywhere, and it's pissing me off. It really is pissing me off. But, I was shocked because after the hearing was over, the whole crowd is milling about there, and there were a few other bills going down, and the chairman of the committee made a beeline for me and came up to me and shook my hand and said, thank you very much for taking your testimony and this and that. And I was like, well, sure. And then the group was interviewing me outside on the front steps of the Capitol. It was cool. It was really cool. I want to do some more of that. Really, really. Cause I mean, people got to speak out because things are, the kind of laws they're wanting to pass now are just so messed up. It's everywhere too.
Actually, the fact that you're seeing it, things like space, standing while being human laws, propagating in a place like Oregon, says that that horse is probably way the hell out of the barn in more backward states, because you've still got a good progressive tradition to fall back on in Oregon. I mean, there's some crazies east of the mountains and everything, but for the most part, a place like Portland, I mean, for somebody like me in Appalachistan, I see Portland as, aspirational, and the Northwest as aspirational, because among other things, up in Washington State, or maybe it was Oregon, they just put an end to another dream of a giant international coal terminal. It's inspiring to somebody like me back here. But the fact that you're already seeing those kind of things, and, that's ALEC. That's the American Legislative Exchange Council. That's
All the way.
These things don't just generate spontaneously.
No, I know. It's all part of a concerted effort. And I I'll tell you what, we do have a progressive tradition here, but... and our legislature has just been, I think we have a super majority in the legislature now, Democrats, but it doesn't even matter because it's just like all, the Democrats and the Republicans, it's like pro wrestling. They're all on the same side. It's like good cop, bad cop. You're going to jail either way, whoever you talk to. Seems like it's really, really getting ugly out here in America, all across. It may have been worse there. It may still be worse there, but it's bad everywhere. Believe me.
And so while you were in the state house, you saw some pistol packing idiots?
No, I didn't, but it was really interesting. There were a couple of bills that were before the one that I spoke on, and they had one on the drones, and they're trying to, bring the drones in, but they're trying to formulate some kind of regulations for the drones because, the drone activists, they had a couple of goobers, total goobers, like in their mission accomplished jerseys there, who were like drone pilots, and they were testifying for the drones. And
you're kidding. They brought in young Roger Ramjet?
I swear to God, yeah. It was a joke. But it wasn't a joke. It would have been if it wasn't serious. But no, they were in there talking about how they're going to save so many lives up on the mountains and search and rescue and yada, yada, yada. And, the senators seemed like they were adamant on limiting how high they can go so they don't interfere with other air traffic. and limiting where they can do this and what, you know, they want to really, really keep an eye on what's, because this is like letting the genie out of the bottle. I mean, you know, I don't want to, you know, dragonfly growing in my backyard.
No.
Or anything else. But there was that bill, and then there was an elder abuse bill, which I thought was really kind of important. But this bill, I mean, the Portland Business Alliance, I was just, you know, nauseated by these people that I was going up, their testimony, and then I followed them, and I was really, it felt so good to just be able to speak out straight up to these people. It was really, really satisfying. Gotta tell you. But this whole thing where they're attacking people and attacking children, I know that's so damned ugly to me. You know, I grew up in L.A., and I went to the L.A. Unified School District. That's where I graduated from. And for them to do that to people, I mean, that is so messed up. So messed up.
What Prager did in this article, though, Dave, is he took one fact, one, you know, mini fact out, and used that as the platform from which to launch his broadside against little people, you know, baby humans. Outside of the fact that what they were saying was that it turned out that eating in the classroom is not the best idea. And I can see where that probably makes sense. Let children sit down and eat a breakfast in the cafeteria where you're equipped to deal with the after effects of people eating food, you know, garbage, waste disposal, stuff like that, so you won't have the bugs and the rats in the classroom.
Right.
That makes sense to me. But instead of seeing that as, you know, just a little bit, because it's an experiment. It's an experiment for the LAUSD. But instead of seeing that as a modification of a plan that is not that's not wrong-headed and evil, you know, because he's a right winger, he has to point out that feeding children food is bad for America. And
now, explain to me again who this guy is.
Oh, he's a second or third tier right wing blatherskate, and fancies himself a writer and a conservative intellectual. You know, they published him over.
Is he from Heritage?
No, he's. I think he's. Well, we don't know the degree to which all of these right wing yahoos are subsidized or not subsidized. We simply don't know. But I suspect that they all are in some way or another. But no, this guy, you know, he writes at National Review online, and people call him up and say, yeah, the welfare is killing America, Dennis. God bless you. I'm so grateful you're out there talking the truth.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Mega
dittos from Busted Knuckle. You know, right. That kind of stuff.
I'm getting kind of pissed off about all this stuff, really. And I don't really think that, you know, we're resisting in any way we can a lot of the stuff that's going on here, but I think that baby boomers like you and me are even more pissed than a lot of the kids, because they don't even know any better. But I mean, it's like,
well, we have to be careful of saying things like that, though, Dave.
Yeah,
because
that's true.
Because I've of late. Taken to thinking back on the me who existed, you know, a couple of decades ago. And hell, looking back, I don't even know if I'd want to be my friend. You know, people, you know, contrary to that statement that people never change, the fact of the matter is there's a couple of scientists out there whose names I cannot remember, but about whom I read several months back, who have said people do nothing but change. We are never this, you know, not only can one person, you know, that old philosophical argument that, you know, if you stick your finger in a river and pull it back out and stick it in again, it's not the same river the second time, okay?
Right.
Because the river was an ancient Greek view of, you know, metaphor for the constancy of change. Well, what we're finding out, what these two scientists have found out, is that not only when you stick your finger in the river the first time and pull it out, when you stick your finger in it the second time, not only are you not sticking your finger in the same river, the same person isn't sticking his finger or her finger in the river.
Right.
Because you know, all the way down to the microcellular level, we are constantly reinventing ourselves.
Absolutely. You know, that reminds me of a story. I in 2003, I saw Paul McCartney in concert. And, you know, I've always been a huge Beatles fan and stuff. And I saw him in concert, and he's an amazing guy. I mean, he had, like, he was about 60 years old. But he just, man, I was more beat up than him after the concert. He played so many damn songs. But it sounded, I thought about that. I thought, God, I bet every cell in his body, he doesn't have a cell in his body from 1963 anymore. But he knew all the songs still. And
right, I mean that's why I love the concept that Kurt Vonnegut kind of pioneered in his own inimitable tongue in cheek way via the space aliens, the Tralfamadorians, who saw not only in three dimension but saw in the fourth, you know, time, and saw any given being as everything they've ever been all at the same time, because that's kind of, you know, that's the nature of the continuum that we're on. And so when I say that we're not even necessarily the same people, you know, we can change, and we can better ourselves, or, you know, we can screw up and things get worse. There's kind of no way of knowing. But if one is conscious, at least minimally conscious of change, then one tries to work toward making such a thing you know, a net positive. The other thing, I got to share this with you, in the chat room, Psychoticus Rex just pointed out something about the idea of the experiment of having children eat in the classroom. And this is just a brilliant observation, Dave. He says, letting kids eat in the classroom is training for later in life, where you'll be eating at your desk doing a 16-hour shift so you can retain the privileges associated with all the other aspiring peasants.
No. We got to turn all this crap around. I'm getting really, really fed up with this. This is just no. Things are just getting too out of control, Bob. I can't. You know, the thing that gets me is I'm not a hugely literary person, but I did read this one book, The Rise and Fall, by William R. Shirer. You know,
you read
that book ever? Did you read that book?
No. Oh, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
And I got that one in my bathroom because it makes good reading, you know. I can open it up anywhere and read a section of it. But, I mean, you know, I see so many things in that book. He just documents everything so methodically and meticulously about what was going on, who was doing what they were saying, and their whole philosophy down to all of their actions. And it's really eerie how history repeats itself, and how what's going on, you know, when you say, I read through it and I'm saying, okay, well, we're about step six in this book, and then what's the next chapter? Oh my God, that's the New Order. That doesn't look very pretty. It doesn't sound good at all. And I just, there's got to be some way to turn things around. I think that things are really, really, really messed up right now. And there's just no way. Hey, by the way, one quick thing I want to say is that I really enjoy things that Sandra has to say on your show.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like, you know, whenever she speaks, I just agree with everything that she says, and she brings up a lot of stuff that's important to me too. I just wanted to let her know if she's listening. I appreciate what she has to say, but I appreciate all your other people, callers. The thing is though that I think there's a collective consciousness that there's a lot of people out there that are going, you know, this is so effed up. We got to do something. Something's going to have to, you know. All hell's going to have to break loose real soon. And, you know, your whole issues around the coal and stuff, we were talking a little bit about that. But I've always been an environmentalist. And it's getting me to the point where I think things are going to start happening a lot quicker than a lot of people are saying. And it really going to be...
Well, did you see the photos of the massive ice wave in Minnesota over the weekend? I kind of chuckled. It wasn't funny for anybody who was coming at.
No, we're talking biblical proportions now.
And of course, you know, if you happen to be tuned into Radio Rwanda for that one, well, proof that there's no global warming. Look at all that ice, Bill.
Oh yeah, I you know what, I think that even some of these people that may have disparaged a lot are coming around to reality. I believe that people are a lot more people are waking up now, and you know, I saw this video that was really I love educational stuff, and I saw this video on solar power in Germany, and that this guy, one of the leading politicians over there in Germany, was talking about how the only way to stop renewable energy from coming in and supplanting this old primitive technology is to impose a dictatorship. And that's what I really think that's the bottom line of all of this. I mean, you know, we really gotta just round these people up and hold them accountable. And I'm really glad to hear. I was reading an article about Blankenship. I hope he goes to prison. I really want to see him go.
I had a lot of people email me that article over the weekend.
Yeah. He's got to go.
Well, he does. The man needs to be doing life without parole somewhere really, really awful. But the fact of the matter is, this is still West Virginia. I'm still a cynic. And I believe he's going to prison when I see him wearing an orange jumpsuit doing the perp walk.
These
two lawyers that were documented in that article have done a heroic. This is the legal equivalent of the labors of Hercules.
Yeah, they're inspirations. They just prove that these people like Blankenship, like Jamie Dimon, like all of these guys, they are relentless and they are tenacious, and we just have to out-relent and tenace them. That's all there is to it. There's no other alternative, because one of two things is going to happen. We're going to have to hold them accountable, or they will kill us all. They will ruin and destroy the world.
Well, you know, Calvin Coolidge was not known for a lot of the things that he said. And he was a Republican, and he's the hedonism of the early 20s is in large part responsible for the hell on earth that was unleashed in the Great Depression. But he did say something along the way that had some value, and you might look it up. The beginning of the quote is, "Nothing can take the place of persistence." And he says, "Education will not. The world is full of educated derelicts," and he lists a couple of other things. And he says, persistence alone and the phrase "press on" have always and will always solve the problems of the human race.
That's right.
Nothing can take the place of persistence. I was taught that as a very, very young man, and it's always served me well.
You know, that brings to mind a quote, or I don't know if it's I'm paraphrasing it, but you know, when McCain-Feingold went down, when it failed. The reporters asked John McCain, they said, "When do you think we can ever get election reform?" And he said, "When the outrage gets high enough, when the temperature gets high enough." And, you know, more and more, I just think that the bailout was a huge mistake. Should have just let it all go down then and hold everybody accountable then 5 years ago and start from scratch. We would have been a lot better off today. We have. But
by the same token, and I'm not excusing it, that is a terrifying abyss into which to stare, because that's an abyss that really does stare back. Because, you know, the Wall Street bankers were holding the entire country hostage. And they whether they were willing to let the whole country burn down is a subject for debate, but it's not really a subject for anything but speculation, because we cannot know. But we do know that the outcome of it was that they were a bunch of graceless, ingrate bastards because of the way they behaved with our money. Meanwhile, big segments of the country, Dave, did burn down, and the ashes are still smoldering.
Oh, believe me, I've seen a lot of it, and it's, you know, things are a lot better now on account of us bailing them out. I got to say, sarcastically, but seriously, I don't think that these people can really we can't ever count on stability again until the people who caused the meltdown are taken out of power and held to account. Just like there's no way it's going to happen. Realistically, it's in the short term. You say, well, gosh, thank God we dodged that bullet, but we really didn't, because the shooter is still on the streets, and I just believe that you know there's going to be no peace, there's going to be no stability, there's not going to be no justice in this country until we do. You see, the Democrats are enablers. That's the thing. You know, I don't like to fight, but there comes a point at which you got to fight. You got to stand up and say, no way, stop.
Well, there's a difference between fighting and self-defense. The mugshot that I saw last week from the Air Force's head of the Sexual Assault Awareness Unit, who got caught trying to rape a woman, and the woman beat the living hell out of him. You know what? That wasn't violence. That was self-defense. That, there's nothing gratuitous in that. Or the story from a couple of weeks ago of the sailor who was in the United Arab Emirates and trying to get back to her ship in time, and got on a bus, and the bus driver tried to rape her, and she beat the piss out of him. You know, that's not fighting. That is self-defense. And at this point in time, I'm beginning to wonder pushing back against the Goldman Sachs's and the J.P. Morgan Chase's and the teabaggers and whatnot, at what point does that become, and I'm not sitting here being a gun goober either, at what point does that become self-defense?
Well, you know, I think that it sounds like maybe we have a little semantic disagreement here, but I think that fighting is fighting, and fighting is violence, and I'm willing to fight though for life. When you're fighting for your life, like in defense, you have a right. That's righteous. People who go after other people, like these teabaggers and this self-justifying crap of wanting to take food out of kids' mouths, literally. This is enough. I'm just getting to the point where it's.
Well, I mean, a Dennis Prager should not be allowed. Should not be prattling this crap in something that calls itself a civilized society. I mean, there is not in history, to the best of my knowledge, a successful culture that has objected to feeding children.
Oh yeah, it's insanity.
Not one.
It's lunacy. I'm at the point though where I'm just. I think it's radicalizing a lot of people, and people on all sides are just getting radicalized, and maybe this is their plan. It's just to forestall moving to a new world, a new technology, is to just have us all just go at each other, and that's obviously what it is. It's dividing people.
Well, I think that's the operative plan right now.
Yeah, they're desperate though. I think that the power that be, which is based on the fossil fuels, I just believe this, and this is my personal belief system, is that these guys, they are desperate. They're sociopathic, homicidal, to the point of being suicidal. They're mad for money and mad for more than, they'll do anything. They'll say anything. And what people have to do, I think, is really come to the point where, to do the hardest thing, which is to, forgive one another. And that's not, it's really, really difficult. I don't know if you were talking about car dealers or something like that in passing, but I was a many, many, many years. And I got really, really good because I learned some lessons of human nature that are just so counterintuitive that, you know, people will say things to you and you can say, you can give an automatic response, which will be a fight or an insult or something else like that. And it's like, you have to, if you really want to go for the gusto and the gold, you've got to kind of just pour through that and talk back to them in a way that doesn't insult them, even though you think they're a freaking idiot. You know what I mean? It's amazing, but you know, like people will come on to me sometimes and I'd reach out to shake their hand and they go, I don't want to touch the hand of a dirty car salesman. And I'd have to say something like, golly gee, sir, did you have a bad experience somewhere else at another car dealer? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it would disarm them. They would be like, what are you, psychic or something? You know? I mean, no, it's just experience that I had that's counterintuitive. I mean, I realized I had to lie in that job. You got to lie as a car salesman. Straight up. There's no way out around it. So I decided instead of lying to my customers, I'd lie to my managers. You know? And it was great. I treat my customers the way they want to be treated and not do what the managers tell me to do. And people would love me. People loved me. You know? I treated people the way they wanted to be treated. And when I understood that maybe, you know, they had a bad experience somewhere else and they had a rough life and, you know, it's amazing. If you fight that intuition to say, screw this bastard, I'll just give him peace of my mind. I did that a few times too. It didn't work out too well. But, no, just trying to understand people. And I think people, you know, you can't change people. 8 years of going on taught me that. People got to come around to the truth on their own. And, you know, it's like people want to be told what they want to hear, but then sooner or later, you got to face reality no matter what.
Well,
no matter what, you got to face reality. And I think a lot of people in the Midwest are coming around to that. A lot of people I bet those folks down in Arkansas, we were talking about that last time, weren't we?
How are you liking that Keystone XL pipeline now that some of it's in your backyard?
Yeah. How do you like that Pegasus pipeline now? They're telling him, I was just reading an article that the state of Arkansas is telling these people, you're on your own. Well, I think they'll think twice before they, the next time they go to the polls. You know, and everybody else.
Well, but then again, I've got postdoctoral level cynicism, Dave, and you know, when you consider, for instance, it was recently announced by Steve King, and I've got a soundbite from him for later if we run out of time, because I mean he's a perpetual Moran Monday kind of guy. But he's decided he doesn't want to be senator from Iowa anymore, and I got to think about why that would be, because I mean this guy's got a high profile. He plays awesomely with the fundies. But then I realized probably the reason he's going to keep being a member of the House instead of becoming a senator from Iowa is that he's running inside a district that, like all Republican districts, has been gerrymandered into something that makes a pretzel look straight.
Right.
And consequently, he could beat Jesus Christ if Jesus Christ was running as a Democrat in his district.
Okay, so he's got a...
On the other hand, it's not the same story. You can't gerrymander an entire state.
Right.
I mean, if it's a statewide race, it's a different story. And, you know, there are people out in Iowa, you know, not just the weirdos who vote for the Steve Kings of the world, but there's a lot of people who went and voted for the guy who was retiring, Tom Harkin, who was a decently progressive Democrat, although he had his flaws. There are people in Iowa who are... vocal supporters of maintaining the marriage equality that exists there. And so that's the dynamic at work there. On the other hand, however, we must deal with the reality, Dave, that these districts have been gerrymandered into something that makes a malaria germ look symmetrical. And consequently, you know, the reality is, I've mentioned it before, and it's not a reason not to work in 14 or 16 or 18 or 20, but we're going to have to wait till the next census to get this country redistricted, and you know, they're, and frankly, the other side works harder at that stuff that we do than we do. That's why the situation exists as it does.
I acknowledge that, but every time, you know, I've noticed this over the years, that every time these Republicans, they try to pull off a plan to, you know, maintain their power, and it doesn't work a lot of the time. I mean, Citizens United did not get, they were saying, oh, this is going to guarantee Romney's victory, and it didn't guarantee him anything. I agree what you're saying about the state level and the redistricting on the state level. But even that, people over time, like you were saying, that we're going through this change and minds are changing because people were, a lot of Fox viewers were watching Fox and they thought Romney would win because that's what all they were saying was that there's no way he wouldn't. And then they woke up to reality and they were, you know, you got to be disillusioned maybe a few times to turn around completely to realize.
Well, meanwhile, I don't know if you caught this or not, but some Radio Rwanda viewers recently staged a boycott of Fox.
Oh yeah, the teabaggers are not. They're not.
Yeah, because they're not doing enough to cover the horrible, horrible malfeasance that is Benghazi.
but I think that Wall Street's getting, they're coming down to reality too, and that's why the Republicans are. I think not to pull any false equivalency here. I think this is happening on both sides. Both sides, the populist base are realizing that they're just totally being betrayed by the corporatists, which is just this one big invisible that's in the middle. That takes up 85% of the middle of the road. You know what I'm saying? I think that these screwballs on the right who think we're screwballs on the left, they're just, you know, Wall Street is saying enough of this. And they can pull the plug on their movement in a minute. But I think, you know, when we talk about individual issues, everybody wants to eat. Everybody's got to eat. Everybody wants their kid to have a good education. Everyone wants to have a home. That's my issue. Everyone's got to have a home. Housing is for everybody. Everybody's got to have a roof over their head. I mean, we're not squirrels living in trees. We got to have a home. And when people are out on the street, living under the bridge down in Portland, downtown Portland, and living under the bridges, and there are empty houses out here. There's empty houses, you know, all over the country. These zombie foreclosures. You heard about this stuff?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, there's zombie foreclosures all over this city here. I mean, I've canvassed the city in all the suburbs and in the inner city all over. I've walked a lot of the streets around here, and you just see so many empty houses. And then there are people on the streets. This is a failed, this is a failed state we're living in, and it's just we've got to turn it around.
Well, there's tonight's moment of profundity, Dave, and it's yours. I've asked in the past. When do we start describing this as a failed state? You're telling me it's
right now,
past time.
Failed state. It's a failed state. We're living in a failed state. When we've got people with more money than they could spend in 20,000 years and people with nothing, that's a failed state. When people are on the streets and they're empty houses, it's a failed state. People got to have a living wage. If they can't, they're living in a failed state, and this, all this with the environment and everything. This is beyond the pale. We gotta try something else. We gotta try something else. And I think that, you know, I think a lot of these right wingers, they have their way of looking at things, which is pretty insane. Yet on some level,
well, you know what? If it was them being foreclosed on and put out on the streets, they would not hold the position that they hold with regard to them. They would, however, continue to hold it with regard to anyone who wasn't them. And that's the essential disconnect.
It's the essence. It's the essence of the conservative mindset.
Justice for thee and mercy for me.
Right. I was talking to Mike Malloy the other night, and I said, you know, Jim Brady did not care about gun control until he got shot in the head. And Nancy Reagan did not care about stem cell research until Ronnie got Alzheimer's. I mean, if it happens to them, it is starting to happen to them, like Pegasus, like all of these things, like they're getting the brunt of this global climate change. They're getting the brunt of it over there in the Midwest, which is the heartland for them. That's going to change their mind. They got to hit rock bottom and have a moment of clarity on their own, and then maybe we can move forward if it's not too late. You know, that's the way I'm seeing it, at least. Because there's no way you or I would, you can talk yourself blue in the face with reason and facts and science and anything else. And
yeah, I've kind of got some experience.
There's no way they're going to accept until it happens to them, and it is happening.
Indeed. Dave, it's been a wonderful conversation. You have yourself a good night.
I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Dave calling from Portland. It is a minute past the hour here as we go into the third hour of the program tonight. This one flying by, as usual. Program note, on the road tomorrow, unless something changes between now and then. So likely no show tomorrow night, but then hopefully back on the air on Wednesday live from D.C. Let's see. That's very nice. Jan writing in. This has been a failed state for many years. That's why we have the need of the Horn and Bob Kincaid. My hubby's been telling me for years that we need to wake up for years. Now it is just that much clearer. Thank you for the kind words, Jan. Thank you very much. I saw it for myself in the heart of the housing crisis, getting to go out into the suburbs around Las Vegas. I'd never seen anything like it. All the houses were empty. Where did the people go? But gone they were. And the houses just sitting there empty. And yes, people struggling to live on the streets of this country. You know, I'm not going to go there. I'm going to go back to the phones. A reminder, we are $115 from meeting tonight's fundraising goal. And again, with me on the road tomorrow, it's going to make it even harder to keep raising those funds. But $115 is where we stand. And many thanks to Sal and to Jack for helping out this evening. Hopefully you will have some other folks jump in as well. Thanks for the kind contributions, by the way, that rolled in over the weekend. It is much appreciated. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob. How are you?
Hey, Bill. How you doing?
Well, I've just got an earful, and it was a good earful.
Good.
Because man's right on the—he's right on the ball, especially man, an honest car salesman. I thought they didn't exist. They didn't exist with me because I learned, I learned the game, and usually I would go. I was going down south and buying clean iron, and because the junkyards up here were full of small block V8s, and you name it, you could get it. And hell, I had a 327 delivered to my backyard for $150. Put that thing in and drove the car 5 more years. So
wow.
Yeah, well, that's the old way of doing things, you know. But this, you keep hitting it on the head. If I hear Benghazi one more time from one of these bastards, I like to put my foot up their down their throat. Because what they know about this, the whole thing, is nothing. What they know is what some guy keeps spouting at them. One of the things about the diplomatic service, this is not the safest job on earth.
No.
Because something is liable, all hell is liable to break loose. And if you're in the middle of it, I mean, what do they want us to do? Station large parts of the army all over every place there's an American diplomat? Hell, of course they would have jobs for these to keep these guys in the army. I know a friend of mine's brother, he was held in for another year when the war broke out in against Saddam Hussein. He was due to get out. He had 20 years in, and they kept him. They didn't say a word about it, but they kept him. This guy was a logistics expert, because the logistics expert, the guy that supplied the bullets and the beams, was pretty important guy or woman, depending on which the case may be, because without either one of those two items, you're kind of useless in the service. But, yeah, I'd like to know if I learned about Benghazi by reading a bio of the Desert Fox himself when I was in the fifth freaking grade, for God's sake. And one of the chapters is called The Benghazi High Stakes, as the British and the Germans, the Africa Corps, raced each other back and forth across North Africa, across Libya, which was what... Saranacea or something in those days. That's your line of work, Bob, not mine.
Yeah,
that's when the Italians owned it. Hell, Europe owned half of North Africa.
Sure.
More.
You know, last night's episode of Parts Unknown, the new manifestation of Anthony Bourdain that's on CNN. Yeah, I'm watching it, especially last night because he was in Tunisia. Tangier, Morocco. And he talked about how that was ruled as a sort of international zone for so many years.
Yeah, they seem to need these zones for, was it financial? Is that why they set them up?
Yeah, well, it's financial, but it was also a means of exerting some, I guess what you might call pan-colonial control.
Ah, okay.
And it provided a bit of a playground for... alternative lifestyle Europeans mainly to go and be able to live their alternative lifestyles without the scrutiny that that existed in other countries.
That sounds like a Bogart movie.
I think there was one. A little town to the west or so.
Yeah. A little minor movie, you know.
Yeah.
It gave you the same picture of the international zone was where people could go in and steal whatever they wanted or live according to the way they wanted. But it's getting to a point where it's starting to show up around here. I remember going to, about 4 years ago, I went up to Toronto to see the new Hockey Hall of Fame. A friend of mine drove me up there, and I never saw more guys sleeping on the streets of Toronto than I did that day.
Really?
It was a lot of... Of course, years ago, we would have just shrugged our shoulders and used the term wino. But in Toronto, it was... different thing to see, because downtown Toronto, the first time I ever went there, I couldn't believe the cleanliness and of the city. Cleveland is, Cleveland was a largely ethnic enclave. This area here was Eastern Europeans. This was Germanic. This was Italian, and it was like that for years and years. And then the old people started dying, and the kids started selling. And lo and behold, the buyers were darker-skinned Americans who were buying these places. So they used to have these neighborhood festivals, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the next thing you know, they sold the neighborhood. The neighborhood went darker. And they wondered why these neighborhood festivals didn't work out the same way anymore.
No, but things rise to take their places.
Yes, exactly.
And the nature of any city is that it too is in a constant state of change. Yeah. But I think you can draw a corollary in that when restrictions. And the same thing goes for social programs as well.
Yep.
When restrictions came in, or when restrictions fell off for home ownership and banks and so forth were no longer supposedly allowed to discriminate based upon skin color. Well, then that's when the Republicans begin manifesting this lack of interest in social programs.
Yeah.
Because they have an inherent disgust, so-called conservatives, Republicans, whatever we want to call them, they have an inherent disgust for anything that does not directly benefit them.
Them, yes.
And so consequently, I maintain, Bill, that part of the urge to, for instance, steal Social Security and privatize it and give it to the boys on Wall Street has its roots in the fact that that the Republican Party is incensed that somebody besides white folks are getting benefits.
Yeah,
when in fact the fact remains that the vast majority of people drawing benefits in this country are white.
Right. Yeah,
it's just that they can't tolerate that anybody else would. Look at, you know, look at this Heritage Foundation study that came out that I was talking about at the beginning of the program. They're incensed. They're incensed. $6 trillion, they're going to get all our Medicares.
Yeah. Well, as I say, I won't be around when the when the language changes. I never did study Spanish, darn me. It was too much work, you know. Do you remember the, was it Berlitz? Or there was another series of books where you could teach yourself a foreign language?
Oh, Berlitz, sure.
Yeah, I know a lot of people. I know young guys who were teaching themselves Spanish and French. And
yeah, and just as a public service announcement, I noticed an internet advertising blitz recently for Plimsleur. Plimsleur, P-L, or either Pimsleur or Plimsleur.
Yeah, yeah.
I-M-P-L or P-I-M-S-L-E-U-R. Don't touch it.
What's he teaching, or she?
Well, I mean, it's
or it.
It's done on CDs and DVDs and stuff like that, and you can play them in your car or whatever. It works well enough. But the problem is, if you take them up on their $10 offer, there's fine print when you click the little box that says go to the pay for it page, that automatically subscribes you to buy one of these units from them every month for $75 a piece.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like the old remember the old record clubs?
Oh yeah, yeah. My dad belonged to Columbia, but luckily for me, my dad was a lover of great jazz, so I got an early education, you know. In fact, I went out and a friend of mine just found a CD copy of a thing made by a bunch of guys who were actually out of the 30s, who were great. It was actually a Dixieland recording, but these guys could play it all. And they were great players. And my dad had a lot of that. The other thing that was going on with him and my uncle was when stereo came in. Do you ever walk in a guy's house and they're listening to two trains collide in front of you?
No.
Yeah, there was a lot of that kind of stuff with stereo lovers. They had to hear, listen to the engine approaching from the left, engine approaching from the right, crash. I don't know, sometimes I wonder about my fellow citizens and their brains.
Well, you know, with the addition of certain herbal substances, that train traveling across your two speakers could become deeply, deeply fascinating.
Well, now that's a criticism of that's one of the things I liked about Barry Goldwater in his old age. I'm trying to remember whether he was on with Carson or Leno, and he talked about reefer, for instance, and how when he was growing up, he grew up in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it was so common that nobody looked too askance at people who happened to imbibe a little bit. It's the old story, if you don't do too much. But the county that I used to live in, which is due east of Cuyahoga, heroin is big news. Friends of mine are having kids that are tied up with that crap. I saw a little of it in the 60s. I remember a buddy of mine asking me, could I borrow you a belt? He wanted to tie off his arm. He says, you want to try this? I said, no, I've tried every other thing. I said, if that stuff killed people like Billie Holiday and Charlie Parker, it's sure going to kill me because they're a lot... They had so much more talent than I couldn't buy the amount of talent those folks had, you know. So I was afraid of it. And maybe this is just a thing that sometimes cowardice is not a bad thing to have. But this talk about, Cleveland, around Cleveland State University, that was all, well, the common term in those days was flophouse. You ever hear that one?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was common term for cheap hotels where you could go in the wintertime, you'd see bottles of milk decorating the outside because they didn't have refrigeration. So if it was cold enough, you put your... And you got your check, and you handed the guy the check for the room, and then you drank up the rest and spent the rest of the month panhandling. This was something that we saw because me and my buddies, we lived near downtown and we could walk downtown. And Christmas vacation was spent hanging around the downtown expensive stores and that, you know, just observing what we didn't know if we'd ever have or not. And, Bob, I had a good piece of it. I was making a living, and my second wife had a doctorate. Not doctorate. She was a master's in psychology, and she was running drug and alcoholism counseling. Well, why not? She had drank herself into it herself, you know. There was a whole lot of that stuff going around, and I just don't know what we're going to do with, you know, you have young kids. What the hell do you tell them to do for an education, Bob?
That's a tough one, Bill. I mean, it's a matter of the only thing you tell it is educate, educate, educate.
Yeah, keep educating and hope for the best, because I don't understand. My hero in part of this mess is Alexander Hamilton, because when he set up the economy in this country, it was set up to operate in and around this country, not this sending of. And the reason they're sending every job overseas is you can't get them any cheaper here. I mean, the jobs that I saw people go into when I was young, hell, when I was in high school, I was working in a knitting shop repairing knitting machines that were patented in 1910. And you kept expecting to see a little kid crawling out with a, dragging a box of yarn like a picture of the British Industrial Revolution. It was amazing what it was. And I don't know what the answer is today, because I'm too damned old for any good use anymore. Except to vote correctly, but for whatever that's good for. And believe it or not, they're chewing at the edges of the social welfare system for anybody, elderly, poor, young, poor. It's the same story. You're absolutely right on the money with what they try to do. And there's a profit in it for somebody. Talk to people who have folks around the elderly, people whose relatives are 85 and 90, and the amount of money that's being skimmed by these so-called good people who are dealing in taking care of these people. If they're taking care of my, hand me the cyanide, will you? When it comes down to it. I mean, that's a horrible thing for me to say, I know. And it's, you know, I'm supposed to be sitting here and saying all kind of things to uplift us. But your last caller, he laid it on the line. You know, he's a car salesman. Yeah, I knew a lot of them. And a good one at least sold decently. He did not really come out and lie, but... you know, if you knew your customers, there was a guy here who was a great clarinetist who thought he was Benny Goodman Jr., which he wasn't, but who the hell was, you know. But he was a car salesman, and this guy used to book 3 gigs in a night. He'd have a piano and a drummer go out to a gig, and he'd show up and play 3 one-set gigs in a night, where he actually would do one set doing Goodman stuff, and then he moved to the next one, and he'd do 3 in an evening. And one night he forgot, and he left his clarinet sitting on top of the car. Whoops. Too bad for that one, huh?
Hmm.
Yeah, it's just the things you observe, but I said, with this Benghazi stuff, just, it doesn't make any sense. It's being a diplomat was always a dangerous job.
Yeah, it is. And I don't know if you have read this. I just read it for the first time today. But one of the things that these fools are hooting about, Bill, is that there was a stand down of military operations headed to Benghazi.
Yeah.
You know what that stand down was? It turns out the stand down was for 4 special ops guys. 4.
Jeez.
Now, I know they are excruciatingly trained, Okay.
Yeah.
But four special ops guys could not have changed that situation.
No, they couldn't have.
But again, between that and the IRS thing, and now this breaking thing about the Justice Department going after telephone numbers, telephone records of folks at the AP, it's going to be a merry summer.
Yeah, it should be a pretty rough time.
I saw somebody say the other day that that the right wing spent the first 4 years of the Obama presidency trying to keep him from getting a second term.
Yeah.
And since they lost that fight, they're going to spend the next 4 years making him wish he had been a one-term president.
Yeah. They're doing their best to...
And frankly, yeah, you can make an argument that that is a direct product of the term limit, the constitutional term limit that we placed on the presidency. More and more and more, I tend to think that that was a terrible mistake.
Well, they didn't like that when Reagan was so popular.
Oh, no, and they all... Well, the right-wingers... Reagan was talking to light bulbs by the time he was done with his second term, but those dumb bastards would have elected him to a third if they could have.
Yeah.
And I'm just about at that place in time where I'm willing to say, listen, let's get rid of that constitutional amendment. It's been as probably as dangerous and deleterious to our civic process as was prohibition.
Yes. And see, how many people can sit here like me and say, well, when I was born, FDR was president?
Yeah, not many.
Not too many anymore. It scares me sometimes, but it's just the idea that
that amendment was created by the Republicans.
Yes.
To make sure there wouldn't be another FDR.
No.
They weren't worried about an American dictatorship. They were worried that the Democratic Party would render them absolutely obsolete.
Yeah, they were. If Ike hadn't been the guy running as a Republican in '52, it would have been a lot different too. A lot of guys who had been veterans thought that Ike was one hell of a guy. And compared with the people, the Republicans who put up there, he was.
Yeah, Wendell Willkie.
Yeah. Well, Willkie was even better than...
Dewey.
These guys were not as bad as some of the people they've been trying to foist on us now.
I always found it interesting that Eisenhower preferred to be called General as opposed to Mr. President.
Yeah, well, I guess that's what he knew. To me, the standard operating procedure, there was a pretty good book I had a couple years ago on the Veterans Bonus March, which is something that most Americans know nothing about.
Right.
When those guys tried to collect some money for putting their butts on the line in World War I, for what? I don't know to this day for what. You know, what did we gain out of that? Anything? Can you tell me something?
No, we're coming up on 100 years, and, well, there are disturbing conclusions that can be reached about World War I that are probably too much to go into now. But
well, the best thing that could have happened would have been the old European sit down and change things.
Well, so, you know, the failings that come out of that with the League of Nations and Henry Cabot Lodge, and it goes on forever. Hey, Bill, it's good talking to you, my friend.
You, man, take it easy. Get somebody else on here.
All right. You have a good night now.
Take care, buddy.
Bye now. Mr. Stress, Bill, calling from Cleveland. And just to let you know, we are at $95 for tonight's fundraising goal. Thanks to Jan and Jerry and Jack and Sal, who have gotten us to where we are. Only $95 to go, and hopefully that'll happen in the next 36 minutes or so. It certainly would be good if it can. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com, and so too is the mailing address under the tab called Contribute. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. It's Juanita from Columbus.
Well, hey, Juanita. How are you this evening?
I'm doing very well. How about you?
I'm well, I think. If it ever gets to be spring here, I'll be even better.
Hey, it's only 50-something here in Columbus.
Yeah, and so, wet and gray and...
Yes, yes. My aunt, who still lives in Beckley, is complaining about her sinuses and various problems with coughing, and I try to explain to her about mountaintop removal and how it was affecting the environment and so forth, and her answer is, well, all I can do is pray. Well, in other words, that means nothing.
Nothing.
I'm not going to do anything. So, but I'm working on her, okay? But for Moran Monday, Bob.
Yes.
I'm going to nominate the left.
Really?
Bob. Yes.
It wouldn't be our first nomination, Juanita.
I'm going back to my old thing when I first called into your show. But before I do that, the thing about welfare, the aid to dependent children was part of the 1935 Social Security Act. At that time, black people were forbidden,
yes,
to have those, you know, those subsidies. They were not able to get those subsidies until 1963. So this is 2013. So basically, African Americans have been eligible for welfare for two generations, not the multiple. When you hear them, the right talk about generations and generations, it almost sounds like it's 100 years. Well, the program isn't even that old. So you know, you get the impression that, you know, that African Americans have been on welfare for, you know, eons and eons, when in fact it's only been two generations. And I think the first welfare check was $10 in 1935. So that shows you how generous we are with our social welfare and with women and children.
Sure.
But, okay, so anyway, I'm going back to this article that was written November the 1st, 1968 in Time magazine. And it's behind a paywall, so you can't get it online. You have to go to the library. But again, Bob, if you read the article, the left was saying the very same thing that they are saying today. There's no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. If we don't get who we want nominated, we're going to stay at home and not vote. And that's what happened in 1968 and why Nixon won. The left was, of course, upset because Kennedy had been killed. And then, I'm talking about Bobby Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
So he was no longer, of course, their only option then was Eugene McCarthy. Well, the Democratic Party went with Hubert Humphrey, and so they were pissed off. So they went home and sat down. And according to this article, like a million voters fell off the rolls in California alone. And so, in my opinion, you can see this same scenario being played out over and over and over again. Eugene McCarthy was pissed because he didn't get nominated. So he tells his followers, basically, well, we're in exile. You know, we're all by ourselves. And that was sort of cold, like, you know, I'm not going to endorse Humphrey. So basically, his voters did kind of like what happened with Ralph Nader, even though we know that it was the electronic voting machines that probably did the most damage. But, you know, it cost Humphrey something like 400,000 votes, and so Nixon got in. Okay, so we were given another chance when Nixon was impeached. Not impeached, was asked to resign.
Yeah, came near to impeaching.
Yeah.
It would have happened.
And so we got, what's his name out? We didn't vote for him, Gerald Ford. And we got Carter in. And I've heard you so many times sing the praises of Carter. But when Carter was in, the left did exactly
Went to bed again.
Huh?
Yeah, went to bed. Went off to lunch. Yeah.
We started in on Carter, and we are responsible for not having universal health care because Carter was going to deliver it, and he had the fix was in, and Ted Kennedy was going to help him until the left approached Ted and told them they didn't like Carter. They didn't like, they wanted him out. He wasn't progressive enough. And so Kennedy reneged on helping with getting the universal health care. And of course, we primaried Carter, and that was a big, bad failure. Carter got in, but he was wounded, and of course, with the lowest turnout, what's his crazy movie star, Reagan, got in. And again, this was because we
Dirty tricks.
chose to, you know, to protest by staying at home. And this has been our pattern over and over and over again. Okay, we get in Clinton, who is, in my opinion, the worst. I mean, now, if the left really wants to cry, Clinton is something to really cry about. I mean, because he did some serious damage. I mean, he, you know, Glass-Steagall, the Telecommunications Act of 1996,
Welfare reform.
And it was under his administration that the Internet that was paid for by taxpayers' dollars was basically turned over to private enterprise. That was under the Clinton administration. And so that's why you see the Internet is so loaded down with advertising. And in the early, not when it was in its early stages, you didn't have that problem. But that's what happened. But anyway, we did the same dance in 96 when we stayed home and the so-called Republican Revolution, or no, it wasn't, it was the Contract with America thing. That's what came in. And, okay, so now it's 2000. And the Republicans know that the way that they went now is to make sure that we don't vote, even when we wake up from our, you know, from our craziness. They want to make sure that our vote, that we stay at home, or that our vote doesn't count. And in 2000, with George W. Bush, look, I live in Ohio. I know what went down here with the voting machines.
Yeah.
And so, and 2004, it was even worse. It was horrible. And even with Obama in 2008, I helped try to get the vote out. And the Republicans were out, and they were taking pictures of people's cars, people in wheelchairs, all kinds of shenanigans. It never stopped. It has never stopped them trying to stop people from voting. And yet, the left knows what is at stake. They knew that women's issues were at stake. They knew civil rights would be at stake, but they were willing to gamble it each time. And now, we're up to 2010. And what do I hear? I see the parade of so-called lefties, as you call them, the shrimp-eating bunch, there's Katrina Vandenhoevel, there's John Nichols, there's David Corn, they're all on television. Arianna Huffington, if you want to call her the left, they're all saying the left's not going to turn out. The left's not going to turn out. And between that and the media continuously playing reel-to-reel coverage of the Tea Party, in promoting the Tea Party, That's exactly what happened.
Well, that was, Juanita, that was the essence of my complaint about Bill Keller's piece in the Times. Yeah, you know, he does some good stuff in the thing, and then he gets down to the nitty gritty of talking about think tanks, and he says both sides do it.
No.
We don't have anything beginning even the bare resemblance of the resources they have or the infrastructure, and that is to the extent that you can give credit for that kind of thing, Juanita, that is a credit to the American corporate structure that took the Powell memo in 1972 very seriously and began acting on it. And that is to our eternal discredit on the so-called left. And again, I reiterate, what left? We sat around and played kumbaya and had drum circles and, you know, played hacky sack and just assumed that the American people would get it right.
Well, I mean,
since I'm up on my soapbox, give me a second here. While we're at it, they built a media infrastructure as well as a think tank infrastructure, and we didn't. And to this day, you've still got people going around who say, "Well, you know, I mean, we've got NPR. I mean." I don't want us to have anybody like that Rush Limbaugh or that Hannity. Oh, really? You don't want anybody out there talking to millions of people a day?
Oh, I agree, Bob. And I remember talking to Bob Vatrakis, who you said you knew, Bob, who's been working on the vote, the situation here in Ohio. And I told him, I said, one of the things the left should work on is the media. I said, we are not consistent. I said, we really need to stay in demand. I mean, we're paying for this media, too. I pay cable subscription fees. You know, we buy products just like everybody else. And we should demand our place in the media. And also, when Rupert Murdoch, I remember reading on a conservative blog that was from England. The guy, I wish I could remember the name of the blog, but he said if the left doesn't take advantage of this Rupert Murdoch scandal, they're stupid. And we didn't.
Nope.
I mean, that scandal.
Well, that really wouldn't have been sporting, would it, Juanita?
Yeah. Well,
I'm sorry. You kind of tripped the wire on one of my little I can go crazy for hours on end things. The fact that here we sit on any given night trying to raise $150.
Exactly.
Okay. And meanwhile, you know, I mean, if you're connected right, if you know the right people and you are a member of the alleged left, you know, you can get subsidized. You can get money.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, if you're not on the cocktail party circuit, if you're not on the Christmas card list, you go begging. And most of us do. There are very few people who are working in this medium, Juanita, who know the right people to get the right checks written. And you know, don't take it from me. Take it from people who have been at this for 10, 20, and 30 years trying to make this happen.
Yes.
And it has been hand-to-mouth, struggle after struggle after struggle. And it's...
Absolutely.
This particular medium is probably one of the greatest tales of pathetic shame that the so-called left has with which to indict itself. It doesn't have to be this way. It doesn't, you know. It doesn't, you know. The fact of the matter is, you know, I think about the number of callers that we've lost since we haven't been able to take care of the stuff relating to the 800 number.
Yeah.
It's just a reality.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be that way. Oh God, I'm not gonna go there.
I would even give Obama credit. For the fact that he did say he did try to deny Fox News access to the White House correspondence room. I don't know if you remember that. And Jay Tapper, at the time was with ABC, went screaming like a little bitch all over the media, and CNN and all the major networks formed, you know, made a pact that they would not cover the White House if Fox News wasn't invited. Now, isn't that something?
Yeah, it tells you a little bit.
That tells you something right there. So it there are things that we, you know, on the left, there have been openings when we could have made, you know, some, you know, made some accomplishments, but we just choose not to do it. I'm looking at this whole Benghazi thing and the whole IRS thing again.
But see, that's the thing. The Jake Tappers, and I guess he's with CNN now or something. But
yes,
but the ABCs and the CBSs, although they think themselves more legitimate than Radio Rwanda, their, you know, their universe of interests is in common with that of the Murdoch operation, and they will band together because you know what? Now, granted, if you go into CNN, which is of course a non-union operation, if you, and I have some experience with this, if you go in as, I mean, when I was there, and it was a million years ago, I understand, I rode my dinosaur to work, but you'd have kids who were learning video editing. Fresh out of college, and they'd be living 5 and 6 and 7 people to a house. They'd all collectively rent a house together, and they were they worked entry level at CNN. And God knows, 1987, I wasn't going to be getting rich working at CNN anytime soon. But the fact of the matter is, there are a lot of people who aren't like that, who are in the up in the thin atmosphere, where they, you know, where they get real folding around money to work with, and they feel, and you know, if you're a millionaire in the media, whether you're Wolf Blitzer or I don't know, Chris Wallace,
right,
or David Gregory,
oh Lord,
y'all have a lot in common. And yes, nothing in common, Juanita, with you or me.
Exactly.
I mean, but it's almost as though they don't see a common humanity with us.
Well, I know that you're a fan of Chris Hayes, and I like Chris Hayes too. But I think even though Ed, you know, he was really not blue collar, but he at least gave the impression he was blue collar. He, you know, I mean, he did look, you know, look, Chris Hayes is probably only read about blue collar people, but Ed has, I mean, he has some background at least associating with people through sports and everything that come from those backgrounds.
Well, Ed, there are things to complain about Ed over. But the fact of the matter is, for people in the so-called heartland, and I even find that phrase kind of odious, Juanita,
mm-hmm,
because it's a backhanded compliment, or it's damning,
yeah,
with faint praise.
Yeah.
But for people in so-called flyover country, or however we want to refer to it, there is an authenticity of life that we sense is not either appreciated or even much understood by our alleged betters, and by flyover country can be anywhere. The heartland can be anywhere. What we are talking about, Juanita, is not geographic. What we're talking about is, in fact, working class.
Yeah.
And there just aren't a lot of folks out there that are working class. And, you know, whether it's Ed or Chris or Rachel or any of the people that we admire, and I admire them all to one degree or another, once that salary passes the passes into the high six figures or low seven, there's something different. You're not the same person anymore. It's not just that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. It's that money does, too. And I'm not going to sit here and go into something about the nobility of poverty, because there is none. There is none. But take any one of us and say, what would you do with Rush Limbaugh's money?
Right.
You know, the first thing out of our mouths is not, I'd have a house like his, you know, 27,000 square feet that I'd share with a cat, the maid, and my wife in a pit. No. We start thinking about, you know, what how could we make our community better? What could we do? What could we do that would uplift more people? And that's, you know, even when people engage in their lottery fantasy, okay, if I won the Powerball, for instance, most of the folks I know, if they have that speculative conversation, they start thinking about, yeah, I mean, for instance, I've had that conversation with one of my buddies, and he says, you know what, mountaintop removal would end tomorrow because I would bury it in the media. I would make it intolerable to set off one more charge. They wouldn't be able to do it without an entire world hating their stinking guts.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, Cosmic Michael pointing it out in the chat room. He says, exactly, Bob. It's a class system issue with the owners and their errand boys versus everyone else. And make no mistake, the Chris Wallaces and the Wolf Blitzers and the Jake Tappers and the David Gregories are the errand boys of the ownership class. And while they've got enough money to feel like they're well healed, they're still errand boys. And I'd say in the dark and still of the night, they still know it, and it still galls, and that makes them want more money.
Of course, but with what I wanted to say about the Chris Hayes thing as well, and that is, though, I think Chris fits a stereotype of the left, and that's the problem I have with him. I want to see people like you.
Oh, no, you don't want to see me on TV, trust me.
Well, yeah, because you want somebody who can connect with both ends. You know what I mean? I can't see Chris Hayes coming here to talk to a bunch of firemen and police officers. I think the
ultimate analogy that maybe, well, as a white guy, that I reach for is, ask yourself if you can see any of the elite so-called left sitting at Darlington watching the race last Saturday night. Okay.
Yes.
You know, when a guy wrecks and they go to the slow-mo, and that's not to say that there's a validity that. No, it's just that they're disconnected from that, you know. And sometimes being able to speak in the metaphor, and sports is the American metaphor, okay?
Right.
Being able
to
speak with some degree of authenticity in the metaphor opens the doors to for your authenticity to speak in others. For instance, that's why I so like Dave Zirin and his Edge of Sports column, the work he does at The Nation, because he gets it. He gets that the doors open when we talk about things that ostensibly matter to a whole lot of Americans. You know, it used to be said that you could gauge someone's personality based on who their favorite Beatle was. Well, you know, come to John Paul, George, or Ringo. Come down south and ask somebody who their favorite NASCAR driver is.
Yeah.
You're going to learn something just from that answer. And that's not meant to be some sort of snide generalization.
Oh, I know. But, you know, I think one of the reasons why Keith Olbermann was so popular, even though I think his left credentials were not that deep, but he did sort of speak in a way, like when the congresswoman was shot in the head and the Arizona thing, the massacre in Arizona. I mean, he spoke out boldly against Sarah Palin and the crosshairs and the whole thing. And the next thing you knew, though...
Goodbye now.
And
right.
You know who were the ones, one of the ones who stabbed him in the back was Jon Stewart on Comedy Central. I was shocked.
Well, we don't really have enough time to do that one, but... Jon Stewart hath his problems. You know, I was pretty well disgusted with that rally on rally on the mall.
How can you have those many people and not 150,000 people and be too cowardly to use that to do something really profound? But, you know, he cares more about the millions, I guess. And so there's that. But if I could just say, squeeze in one thing,
sure,
and then
thing.
I'll get off. In this article, they were talking about African American. At the time, there were radical African Americans telling African Americans that their vote, it didn't matter if they voted or not. I mean, these were progressive radicals, people like Eldridge, Cleaver, and so forth. And so I think, if you look at today, for example, you can see, in my opinion, how voting in the African American community. Now, at that time, in 68, Whitney Young said that African Americans, that white liberals could afford not to vote, but African Americans could not. And when I look at the Trayvon Martin case, for example, you wonder, how did those crazy Republicans get in? Well, there's 700,000 unregistered African Americans in Florida. Now, Jesse Jackson put that out, and they were trying to, I don't know what the how many they've been able to register since then, but at the time of that, when that case broke, that's how many were unregistered. And in Georgia, where the young man was put to death, Troy Davis.
Yeah.
600,000 African Americans eligible that are not registered to vote. So you can see in these states, and I think I've talked to you about this before, where these you look at and you wonder, how did these people get in power? And it's always because there's this large swatch of people not voting. Okay, you look at Michigan and how that crazy governor, he's acting like a dictator. Well, in Detroit alone, there's almost a million black people in Detroit alone. So there's something, you know, and I've heard people say over and over again, oh, it doesn't matter. Whether they be black or white. Oh, it doesn't matter. Voting doesn't count. It doesn't matter. It's going to be the way it is, no matter what. Well, that could be true. However, Bob, if you know you're going to get your hand smacked, you can either pick the one that has the hammer or the one that has the axe. So, I mean, you know, one is going to break your fingers, but the other one is going to obliterate your fingers. So, you have that choice.
Oh, absolutely.
So I'm going to go. I didn't mean to hold up the telephone this long. I
apologize. Oh, no. It was a delightful conversation. Don't you apologize.
Okay, Bob. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Juanita. You have a good night.
Good night.
Bye now. Juanita calling from Columbus. She has roots here in almost level West Virginia, Stan. Good to hear from her. It is about 7.5 minutes before the hour, and pretty close to time to go. Again, a reminder, I'm going to be on the road tomorrow to Washington, D.C., so likely, most likely, no show tomorrow evening. Try to get back to the air for a prayer meeting Wednesday, and oh, Lordy, that one's stacking up, too. So it looks like we'll probably be busy. Good news, we are down to $85 to go for tonight's fundraising goal. It feels a little bit more reachable. Thanks, Henry, for joining in with Jan and Jerry and with Jack and with Sal. It is much appreciated. We can make this work. I mean, but the thing is, you know, part of what I was getting at is, well, if there was some way for me to be some progressive think tank's fellow, I'd love to do that. And they have them. But it ain't likely to happen. And it ain't likely to happen largely because I don't do the company line very well. Sooner or later, I'm going to say X is wrong. And X may be completely all right. By, you know, for people who value access more than they do, say, right or wrong. And that costs. And it costs here. So there's no way that I'm ever going to be somebody's foundation fellow. Lord knows, might be, heck, maybe, I don't know what it's like to be a feller. Maybe it'd be enough money that I could stop the fundraising here and give you guys a break. But it hasn't happened, and it isn't likely to happen. And so the only way to keep this going and to keep, and the same applies to other people, and it's not just radio, it's the blogging world. You know, there are people out there who don't have health care in the blogging world, too, who are doing tremendous work. And they're doing it because it matters. They're doing it because it matters to them, because it is of critical importance. But no health care. No retirement. Nothing. Nothing except for those who let us know that it matters what we do. And that's y'all. And that is the gritty determination that y'all have shown over the course of years to keep this going. And I haven't really done a full-on hardcore, I guess, by my standards, funding request in a while, but I guess this is it. This is it being the funding request, not the end of anything, but this is the funding request. We're up close to the middle of May. We'll be there in another 2 days now. Three. And like I said, we ended April in a hole. Thanks to the Beat the Swede advance, we've been able to replace the equipment that has kept us on the air. Thank you. Thank you, Scott. And thanks to everybody else who stepped in. Remember, there is an ongoing contest for anyone who wants to join in on the naming rights for the hard drive, for the sound card, for the motherboard, for the power supply unit. I guess we could also name the memory sticks. But if you want in on that, a simple contribution will get we'll get you there. All you have to do is let me have send you a note along the way saying I'd like to get in on the naming rights drawing, and that will happen in early June. One more trip to the One more trip to the phones, real quick. Hey, welcome to the program.
This is Edward.
Hey, Edward.
I just want to tell you real quickly. I don't mind listening to you on Skype. But do you realize you all sound like Elmer Fudd on Skype?
No.
You do. It's rather unusual. I mean, it's just a lot of lisping going on.
That must be part of the algorithm or whatever. But no,
it,
I didn't notice
it probably is. Doesn't bother me because I listen to you anyway. But I thought it was rather amusing.
Well, it is. It is indeed.
Take care.
All right, have a good night, Edward.
I'm just an old curmudgeon.
You curmudgeon on. We're happy to have it. You take care, Edward.
Hey, take care.
Bye now. And thanks, everybody, for helping make this go. We will talk probably Wednesday, I'm guessing. Thanks to everybody who makes it happen. You with your kind contributions. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to John Fox in Australia, our engineering consultant, web designer, man of many talents. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. You can always get the podcast at WhiteRoseSociety.org, and Ben has never sent a bill. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the people at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AICACT.org. I will, of course, be headed to Washington, D.C. to work on the AICACT. AICACT.org, and you can help out by contacting your member of the House of Representatives and telling them you want them to sign on, thank them, or encourage them if they've already signed on to help us get others signed on. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Here comes Rick Smith.